Let's wait about 30 seconds for Pat to return to the room. Alan, then I'll just instruct everybody to turn the recordings on. And then if you could refresh your first slide a couple of times, we're ready to go. Then I guess Robin is probably going to do the introductions. Okay, why don't we all turn recordings on? And in about 15 or 20 seconds, Alan, if you could refresh the first slide a couple of times, we can begin.
Great. Good afternoon, everyone, or good morning, depending on where you might be joining us from. But I'd like to welcome you to the ADA Audio Conference program, which is actually our legal webinar. We have a multitude of different programs and series that we offer under our ADA Audio a headline, and this particular Legal Issues webinar series started in January of this past year, and we will run through September with a total of 6 programs. So we have a few more to go, and I again welcome you. This program is being brought to you as part of the regional ADA Center network across the country, also known as the Disability and Business Technical Assistance Centers. This program is hosted by the DibTech Great Lakes ADA Center, and we serve the Great Lakes region of the country. Our session today will be conducted by Alan Goldstein. Alan is a senior attorney with Equip for Equality, which is the Illinois Protection and Advocacy Agency for People with Disabilities, and manager of the Illinois ADA Project, which is the affiliate of the Great Lakes ADA Center. And we receive our funding from the National Institute on Disability Rehabilitation and Research, otherwise known as NIDR. Mr. Goldstein has been practicing law for over 20 years and has specialized in the area of disability rights for more than 15 years. He's provided Americans with Disabilities Act employment-related training to human resource professionals, businesses, judges, attorneys, service providers, people with disabilities, government agencies, and other organizations, utilizing his expertise as an attorney to provide practical information. Mr. Goldstein collaborates with chambers of commerce, business leadership networks, SHRM members, and other professional organizations to understand and address employers' concerns regarding the ADA. Our session today, which is, as I said, one of several that we're offering throughout the year, is, having a little blip in my technology part, titled ADA Coverage Beyond Actual Disability, Regarded As, Record of, and Association Disability. Again, this is an area that we often don't hear people focus on in a lot of the training programs. A lot of focus is on who is a person with a disability and the debates and the discussions around what is happening now nationally related to the ADA Restoration Act and subsequent ADA Amendments Act of 2008, passed by the House a few weeks ago. But this part of the definition of disability also needs attention and needs to understand how its case law is developing and how people are dealing with it across the country and looking at its impact on people with a variety of different disabilities that may fall or not fall into this particular area of coverage. So I'm going to turn it over at this time to our speaker, Alan Goldstein, just to remind people that this program is being recorded and it will be made available through the archives on our www.ada-audio.org website. The materials for today's session, including a copy of the PowerPoint presentations and a legal brief addressing this specific topic, will be emailed to all of those who have participated in the program today at its conclusion, and at the same time, we will be asking you to complete an evaluation on the program. So understand that you will be receiving a copy of the PowerPoint presentation from today, as well as a legal brief, which our speaker, Alan, will be referring to throughout the session. So at this time, I'm going to turn it over to you, Alan.
Okay, thank you, Robin, and thank you for this opportunity again, and thank you to all the participants taking part today, and welcome back to those of you who have been here before, and welcome to the new people. Those of you who have taken part before in the past, we've done these sessions with myself and Barry Taylor, who's Equal for Equality's Legal Advocacy Director. Today it's just me, so I apologize for that. But I think we'll be able to get through all the information. One thing I ask, though, is if people do have questions, I think we're going to save all questions till the end. I anticipate going about an hour with the PowerPoint, and then we should have almost a half hour or so for questions. And people are also free to email me after the webinar at any time, and some of you have done that in the past, and I try to be prompt in responding. So today's session is on ADA coverage beyond actual disabilities, and the three parts we'll be talking about are regarded as, record of, and discrimination based on the association with a person with a disability. The topics are probably not as discussed as the other ADA topics, but I think they're important. They're important for employers, they're important for employees, and these are the topics we're going to discuss today, just a very general outline. We're going to talk about some disability issues in general, and then we're going to get to regarded as issues and cases, record of issues and cases, and then association issues and cases with some practical tips. These seminars are designed to be somewhat technical, so we don't do much ADA 101 or the ABCs of the ADA. So if people do have questions on that, certainly ask at the end, and we'll try to answer those. But the focus of these webinars is to provide the more technical information using EEOC guidance and case law to help everyone navigate their way through the ADA. So here's an overview of some ADA issues, and we're going to spend just a little bit of time on this. First, to be protected under the ADA, a person must meet one of the four conditions set in the bullet points. Either they have a disability that substantially limits one or more major life activities, and that's the bullet point we will not be discussing today, or they must be regarded as having such a disability by the employer. The person, if not, they must have a record of an ADA qualifying disability or have a relationship or association with a person with such a disability. And we're going to be talking about the last three bullet points there, regarded as, record of, and association. I just want to say a word, as Robin alluded to, the ADA Amendments Act of 2008, which was originally called the ADA Restoration Act, has passed the House. And it is a result of negotiations between the business community and the disability community. And some of these definitions would change under the ADA. And I just want people to know, one, the brief that Robin alluded to that's going to be distributed at the end of this webinar, it's fairly extensive, and this PowerPoint is more just highlights from the brief. So people who want more information, I certainly urge you to look at the brief later, and that has more in-depth information of the cases we discussed, cases we are not going to discuss in the PowerPoint, and regarding the ADA Amendment Act. One question I want to address off the bat is the issue of reasonable accommodation under these types of disability coverage, and some of it is less than clear the way the law stands now. As it currently stands, people who are regarded as having a disability generally are not entitled to have a reasonable accommodation, but there is case law that indicates that people who are regarded as having a disability may be entitled to an accommodation. And that case was, the case that's on that point is Williams versus Philadelphia Housing Authority, which alludes to it, but most courts have held that people who are regarded as having a disability are not entitled to accommodations. And I think the one exception would be if the accommodation would be a change in interpersonal interaction. For example, if a supervisor treats an employee in a derogatory manner, assuming they're disabled, that's a situation where I can see an accommodation in a regarded as situation. But generally, it is tough to get accommodations in these situations, although there is case law going both ways. The EEOC has not taken a firm position on that, whether accommodations are required for people who are regarded as having a disability. But one important point is under the ADA Amendments Act, it would clearly state that people who are regarded as having a disability are not entitled to reasonable accommodations. Regarding accommodations for people with a record of disability, the EEOC holds that people in this category are entitled to reasonable accommodations, and most courts have generally held that as well, looking at all the other considerations for reasonable accommodations. And the ADA Amendments Act would not change that. So people with a record of a disability are generally entitled to reasonable accommodations. And then with the next category, people who feel they've been discriminated against based on an association with a person with a disability. Again, in this group, it is generally held that there is no reasonable accommodation for people based on an association with someone with a disability. So employers do not have to give time off under the ADA for people to care for spouses or children or other family members, but very important to know that under the Family Medical Leave Act, the time off may be required, but not under the ADA. And I think this would probably not change under the ADA Amendments Act. One more change that the Amendments Act would involve is that currently the law is to show that a person is regarded as having a disability, they must show that the employer regarded them as having a substantial limitation in a major life activity. That requirement would be eliminated under the ADA Amendments Act. Excuse me, the person would only need to show that they're regarded as having an impairment, not necessarily that they have an impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities. And I think that was part of the trade-off in the negotiations. The standards regarded as have been made a little easier for people to fit that category, but it is now explicit in the Amendments Act, if that passes, that people who are regarded as having a disability would not be entitled to reasonable accommodations. So I hope that's clear. I know that's a lot of information, but I just wanted to handle the reasonable accommodation issue off the bat because it's somewhat tangential to the rest of the PowerPoint. One thing I also wanted to mention in terms of one of the basics of the ADA, any employee must be qualified to do the job, whether they have an actual disability, whether they're regarded as having a disability, whether they have an association with someone with a disability or a record of a disability, they still must be qualified. And an employee is qualified for a position under two conditions. One is kind of the general qualification. They must satisfy the requisite skill, experience, education, and other job-related requirements of the position. And then the second part is the part we're familiar with under the ADA. The individual must be able to perform the essential functions of the position either with or without a reasonable accommodation. In a lot of the regarded as cases, the qualified issue is key. Generally, when an employer regards an individual as being unable to perform some essential job functions, but doesn't regard them as having a substantial limitation, then that person is just generally deemed to be unqualified. If there is medical substantiation that a person cannot perform essential job functions, for example, if lifting 50 pounds is an essential job function, and a person with a disability cannot do it, then that person is not qualified for their job. And if you're not qualified, it doesn't matter whether you're protected under the ADA or whether you meet the ADA's definition of disability or not. And I think in some of the court decisions, we'll see that courts sometimes blend this. I think in some of the cases that we'll talk about today and some in the brief, I think it appeared to me that the person was regarded as having a disability, but it also appeared to me that the person was not qualified for their job. And sometimes courts don't take that route in their decision. They just find that the person was not regarded as having a disability, even though they may well have been regarded as having a disability and are just not qualified. So I think in some of the court cases, we'll see courts kind of blur the distinction a little bit. And here's some warm regards. Employees regarded as having a disability. In general, regarded as cases fall into two categories. One, the employer mistakenly believes that a person has an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity when the person has no impairment whatsoever. Or if the person does have an impairment but it is not substantially limiting, then the employer mistakenly believes that the impairment does cause a substantial limitation in one or more major life activities, even though it does not. And that delineation of the two cases is from the Sutton case, part of the Supreme Court trilogy on the definition of disability. And the EEOC has some guidance where they actually break it down into three categories, but I think that gets too confusing. I'm a simple person, so the two categories delineated by Sutton, I think, sum it up fairly well. And as I mentioned, employees must be qualified. Generally, employers do not violate the ADA when they have valid, non-discriminatory reasons for adverse employment actions. The employer's reasons must be legitimate, job-related, and consistent with business necessity. And in these situations, if an employee is unable to meet a job-related condition of employment or a job-related duty they have to perform, then that person would be unqualified, again, whether or not they have a disability under the ADA. However, if a reasonable accommodation would enable the employee to be qualified, then the employer must provide it, and that's basic ADA law. And here's some examples of valid non-discriminatory reasons for adverse employment actions. So, for example, sleeping on the job, as the picture shows, would be a valid reason for termination, even if it's disability related, and again with the caveat, if someone's sleeping on the job because of reaction to medication or because they're limited in sleeping, then the employer needs to investigate whether an accommodation will enable the person to perform their job duties. But if there is no accommodation that will help someone do their job and stay awake on the job, then that person would not be a qualified individual with a disability. And here are some examples of valid non-discriminatory reasons for adverse job actions. Either poor job performance on the part of the employee, violation of legitimate workplace rules, even if it's a disability that in some measure is responsible for an employee violating a workplace rule, as long as the rule is job related and consistent with business necessity and there's no reasonable accommodation that will enable the employee to comply with the rule, then that would be a valid reason for an adverse employment action. If the employee poses a direct threat to the health or safety of themselves or others that cannot be eliminated or reduced by a reasonable accommodation, that would be a reason for taking adverse job action. But again, the direct threat standard is a very high standard, so employers need to make sure they have the best available objective medical or scientific evidence on that. The next bullet point, if the employee is viewed as only being able to unable to perform one or more specific essential job functions, so the employer is not saying, I don't see you working in any job, I don't see you working anywhere, they're not saying that. They're saying, I think you're unable to lift 30 pounds. That's what your doctor says. The job requires that you lift 30 pounds all the time. Therefore, you're not qualified. And we see in case after case, oops, someone just told me they can't hear anymore. So I'm going to try to lock the talk key again. Okay, well, Claudia said she can hear fine, so hopefully it's working. But please let me know if I fade out, let me know. The technology still has some glitches. So I'm assuming it's okay. So in case after case, we see where employees are viewed as just being unable to perform a job function, a specific job function, and are not viewed as limited in working or something broader. Employers' actions in those regards and the termination and other discipline has generally been upheld by the court. And again, it's very important that employers base these decisions on objective, reliable criteria. Courts frown upon where employers kind of tilt the medical evidence or rely on their doctor and ignore the treating doctor, or have a company doctor influence medical opinions, or where employers base decisions based on stereotypes or fears or misconceptions rather than on actual factual data. Courts generally find that employers are wrong when they take those actions. It's very important for employers to have specific, objective, reliable facts that they rely on, and it's really important that employers focus on conduct of employees and not necessarily the disability of an employee. And again, employees must be qualified and they must meet legitimate business expectations. Under the ADA, employers never have to lessen attendance requirements, quality requirements, quantity requirements. They never have to forgive anyone or excuse anyone from complying with legitimate job-related workplace rules. And the rules, again, have to be job-related and consistent with business necessity. And employers, again, always have the duty to investigate whether a reasonable accommodation will enable an employee to be qualified. And then for protection for employers. Employers are often afraid, for example, if they provide an accommodation to someone who just has a backache and clearly does not have an ADA disability, if they buy someone a chair cushion or give them extra rest time, employers fear that they may be then seen as regarding the employee as being disabled. And courts overwhelmingly bend over backwards not to make that conclusion. And in case after case, they say, if an employer chooses to go beyond the ADA, we're not going to make them keep that. When an employer is given accommodation that's not required, and then at some point even arbitrarily decide to withdraw that accommodation, courts support that. They really bend over backwards not to, I don't know if punish is the right word, but not to put any extra burden on employers when they go beyond the ADA. But I think for employers, it's very important to make sure that that's documented, to say, we don't think this is an ADA disability case, but we're buying you a back cushion. I think when employers can be explicit in those regards, that can help. In some of the cases, employer statements may help them show that they did not regard the person as being disabled, or employer statements may go the other way and show that the employer did regard the person as being disabled. So focusing on conduct and documenting things is very important. And on those lines, employers have been found not to be regarding an employee as being disabled just because they extend family medical leave or other medical leave, they grant someone a sabbatical, refer a client to an employee assistance program, or provide workplace modifications when it's documented that it's not being done in regard to the ADA. In those cases, courts have held that the employer was just doing more than they wanted to, and if they want to stop doing that, they are free to do so. And I have some cases cited there in the bottom. All those cases are in the brief that you will be receiving after the webinar. As I alluded to, statements and actions of employers are very important in these regarded as cases. They may show that the employer regarded the employee as disabled, which may be evidence of discriminatory conduct. Or they may demonstrate that the employer just regarded the employee as being unable to perform a certain job function, which, as I mentioned before, would not be discriminatory. So it's very important, and we'll see in some of the cases how courts have interpreted that. And then in medical evidence, we'll see several cases that discuss medical evidence. Employers are generally on strong ground if they have medical substantiation for their conclusion that the employee cannot perform essential job functions. However, when employers rely on company doctors and ignore contrary medical opinions, particularly those of treating physicians, courts are less likely to find for the employer. And we'll see some cases where the employer's doctor actually had other doctors change their opinion after speaking with the employer's doctors, and courts pretty much saw through that and said that that was not a valid medical opinion because it was influenced by the employer. And some good EEOC guidance is alluded to at the bottom of the page on medical examinations and inquiries of employees. And just to let you know about some great resources, one, if you're in the Great Lakes region, the Great Lakes Disability Business Technical Assistance Center or another area DIBTEC, if you're outside of this region, have a lot of ADA information. The Protection and Advocacy Agency, which are located in every state and territory, can help. The EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, has some excellent guidance in this area. And when you're looking at accommodation issues, I always encourage people to contact the Job Accommodation Network as well. Okay, we're going to get to the first case now, and that's really the company's name, CHU2A Inc. Not surprisingly, it was a kind of an engineering type of firm. In this case, Horde, an employee was terminated 1 year after being diagnosed with Graves' disease, and for the 6 months immediately prior to his termination, courts, he had some problems at work, including being unable to account for 300 hours of work time, obviously a serious problem. He had had several altercations with supervisors and coworkers. In fact, after one argument with a coworker, he just left work without leave or without any permission. He went AWOL and missed an important meeting at work. And generally, prior to those 6 months, he had favorable work reviews, but there was a noticeable change in his performance in the 6 months immediately prior to termination. And some of the statements, the supervisor made several comments that the employee developed behavioral problems and was inappropriately aggressive. And the employee was also called unreasonable and intolerable by the employer, and was told he had become a, quote, an undue hardship and a liability. And it's interesting that they used the ADA words in telling the employee what they thought of him. And the questions, do these statements indicate that the person is regarded as being disabled, or they just indicate that the person was having problems interacting with others at work? And the court found that the supervisor's comment reflected the employee's behavior at work. They were saying he was intolerable and difficult and conflicts, which really is conduct-related comments. So the supervisor's comments reflected the employee's behavior at work, not misconceptions about his abilities. And the employer had a valid performance-related reason to terminate the employee. He was having an increasing number of conflicts with coworkers and supervisors, and was totally unable to account for 300 hours, which he had included on his timesheets. And therefore, the termination of this employee was upheld by the court. And in this case, even though the employer's comments did not hurt the employer, I don't know if they helped all that much, so I always urge caution. Employers should always be cautious in how they phrase things and how they speak to people with disabilities. Again, focusing on conduct and not medical issues is generally the best approach. In this case, the employer documented all their performance concerns, which helped them for sure. And their focus on conduct was also helpful. I think those are the keys in a lot of these cases, is for employers to handle things in that regard. And one thing, too, I'm going to go back a second. In the Hort case, the court did spend some time talking about when someone is regarded as substantially limited in the major life activity of working. I didn't want to go into too much depth on this because, one, it's not very clear. There hasn't been a lot of guidance in terms of what does it mean to be substantially limited in working. The Supreme Court has kind of even questioned whether working really is a major life activity. The EEOC considers it a major life activity of last resort. But generally, the law says that in order to be substantially limited in the major life activity of working, a person, the inability to perform a single particular job is not a substantial life or substantial limitation in the major life activity of working. The person must show that they are significantly restricted in the ability to perform either a class of jobs or a broad range of jobs. And that's what a person needs to do to establish that substantial limitation in working. So I just want to allude to that. That's something discussed in the Hord case. The next case is Squibb. In the Squibb case, the employee, a registered nurse, was issued a permanent work restriction from lifting more than 25 or 30 pounds. And this was actually the result of three work-related injuries which led to this restriction. And a lot of times we'll see a connection between workers' compensation and disability issues, particularly where obviously the injuries at work lead to some type of disability. And that's why I think it's important for employers to really look at these from the beginning and make sure that they have a cohesive policy. So employers may want to provide, for example, a wrist rest to someone using a computer even though they don't have a disability, because it might help prevent carpal tunnel syndrome. And as long as that's documented and it's made clear it's not pursuant to the ADA, it's just something the employer wants to do, I think that's generally a good policy and can help prevent from workers' compensation liability. Anyway, back to the case. Because of this nurse's restriction, she can no longer perform the essential duties of her job and was reassigned to a new one as a patient placement coordinator. She was also given a permanent light-duty position, and at some point the employer said, our light-duty positions are really designated as temporary jobs. So she sought a permanent light duty position, but the employer had designated the light duty position as temporary, and the court held that there was no duty for the employer to make the temporary light duty job a permanent light duty job. And that's generally the case. As long as the employer so designates a light duty job as temporary, the employer has no duty to make that into a permanent job to accommodate someone with a disability. And because of the employee's continued frequent absences, she was placed on administrative leave and then later terminated when she refused to return to work in a new position. The court also noted that the employee had what it called lukewarm performance reviews. And the court ruled that the medical restriction instituted by the employee's physician showed that she was no longer qualified for her position. However, she was not regarded as being disabled in the major life activity of working. And that's one of the things I was alluded to before. I think what the court could have said is she was regarded as being disabled in the major life activity of working, because it seemed that she couldn't work as a nurse anywhere. But that being said, she was unqualified for her job at Squibb because she could not do the essential job functions. The court didn't go that route, instead saying she was not regarded as, and I think even though you get the same result, you know, the employee ends up losing the case, so to speak, I really think that if someone is unable to do a duty which is seen as standard for that profession, then maybe they are being regarded as limited in the life activity of working, but they're still not qualified for the job because they have to be able to lift that weight. And there's several more of these cases in the brief where I point out where I feel the court may have kind of jumped over the regarded as issue or found a person not regarded as being disabled, when in fact the person may have been regarded as being disabled, but in the end was not qualified for their job. The court held, though, that the employer did not mistakenly believe that the employee had a substantial limitation working, only that she was limited to the extent of her doctor's restriction, which leads to another point, too. I think it's, you know, very important for people to make sure that medical evidence doesn't just substantiate that they're unqualified and do nothing further, because they may end up writing themselves out of a job if they're not qualified for their job, and there's no job available for which they're qualified for reassignment, then the person can be terminated without any violation of the ADA. I generally think in terms of a tip for an employee, if you're going to submit medical evidence and you can't lift 30 pounds, I mean, you need to be accurate, but if there's an accommodation that would help you lift, or if it's possible because of the nature of the job to have help lifting or to use a cart or to use some type of device to assist with lifting, I think it's important to have the medical information mention this as well, just to make sure that the duty to accommodate someone with a job restriction is examined as well. And again, this is what I was saying, the employee's medical information rendered her as being unqualified. And again, when an employee is unqualified, employers may reallocate essential job functions, but there is no legal requirement under the ADA for employers to do so. The ADA only may require that employers reallocate non-essential job functions. An employer never has to reallocate essential job functions. And then once a person is no longer qualified for their present job, reassignment, the accommodation of last resort, is the only available reasonable accommodation. And as I alluded to, it may have helped the employee had her physician suggested reasonable accommodations that would have assisted her in lifting rather than just the blanket, the employee cannot lift 30 pounds. In the end, that just showed that she was not qualified for her job. The next case is the Hartway case. And in this case, an employee was terminated from a cooking position after the employer learned that she was being treated for hepatitis C. And actually, this case was interesting because the employee did not originally disclose this. As you may know, after a conditional job offer, employers can ask any medical information they want. And in this case, they did, and the employee did not disclose her hepatitis C. And whereas generally people do not need to disclose a disability unless and until they need an accommodation, the exception is for new job applicants, once they receive a conditional job offer of employment, the employer can ask for medical information as long as it's done uniformly of all people coming into that position. In this case, the employee did not disclose her hepatitis C, and often courts held, well, if a person lies, it doesn't matter if they were discriminated against or not. But in this case, the court did not hold her failure to disclose against her. Instead, the court looked at some comments the employer made. How would you like to eat food containing her blood if she ever cut her finger? If this got out to the clients, they would have a mass exodus from the nursing home. And in fact, these comments were made by the employer to the EEOC investigator. Generally not a good idea. You don't want to argue your case with the investigator. The employer also had told the employee that you have hepatitis C, you will not work in our kitchen. And the employer later argued, well, we just meant they couldn't work in our kitchen. We didn't mean they couldn't work in any kitchen. But the court found that the comment, even though you said you could not work in our kitchen because of your hepatitis C, the court was really saying, or the court found that the employer was really saying, we don't think you should work in any kitchen with hepatitis C. And therefore, the employee was regarded as being disabled and was protected by the ADA, even though her hepatitis C in of itself was not substantially limiting. And here, I certainly agree, and I think any disability advocate would agree, that safety is important. I don't think anyone wants people with disabilities working in a workplace if it's unsafe for them or unsafe for other employees or unsafe for customers, and it's very important in the food industry as well. But here the employer merely acted on stereotypes regarding hepatitis C rather than medical information. And in fact, we see in the second bullet point, the EEOC has guidance that's titled How to Comply with the ADA, a Guide for Restaurants and Other Food Service Employers. In that case, they list the four types of conditions transmittable by food that may disqualify someone from working in food service if there's no accommodations. And while hepatitis A is on that list, hepatitis C is not. And again, that's why employers need to base information on decisions on objective information, not stereotypes, generalizations, or preconceptions. And then I skipped over the first bullet point. The court also discussed the Squibb case that we discussed previously in here, because the employer made those comments, you will not work in our kitchen with hepatitis C, meaning you shouldn't work anywhere with hepatitis C. The court said this case was different than the Squibb case, because the employer regarded the employee's limitations much more broadly than in Squibb. And then the last case is the Taylor case. I think it's the penultimate case, is the Taylor case, where a forklift driver had two seizures. A neurologist determined that the medical tests were consistent with the seizure disorder, and he told the employer that he had infantile epilepsy, is the phrase he used. The employer would not let him return for over 18 months, even though the employee was cleared by two physicians who originally cleared him from work, but then after speaking to the company doctor, they reversed their opinions, which is something that the court came down hard on the employer for. And the court held that the employer's refusal to let the employee return to work was based on the assessment of doctors who reporting to and retained by the company, and that clearly the employer used the company doctor to get the other doctors to change their medical opinions, and therefore found that the employer regarded the employee as being disabled and violated the ADA. And I don't think he used Groucho, Harpo, and Chico, who's up there in the corner, but by having the company doctor influence the other doctors, it really hurt the company's credibility in their decision. And again, it's dangerous for employers to rely solely on company physicians and ignoring contrary opinions. And just, you know, a lot of the cases come up on summary judgment where the court is looking to see whether there is any factual issues, any material issues of genuine material issues of disputed fact, which gets to go to a jury, or whether there's just questions of law that need to be decided, in which case the court can decide on summary judgment questions of law without the case going to a jury, as long as there's no factual dispute. The Taylor case was not a summary judgment dispute. It was a case on appeal after a jury award, and the jury awarded almost $160,000 in back pay and compensatory damages and $290,000 in attorney's fees for the employee. Plus, of course, the employer had to pay their own attorney's fees, so these can be costly propositions. And my favorite thing about the Taylor case is that his supervisor was named Sailor. So it's S-A-Y-L-O-R. So it was back and forth between Sailor and Taylor. And now I believe this is the last regarded as case is Justice. And we'll go through this a little quickly. This is a little lengthier case. But in this case, Justice was an electrician who had a stroke which caused vertigo. And while he appeared unsteady, he did not have difficulty walking or standing. As an electrician, he had to climb ladders, walk on catwalks, use power pressers and cutters. A medical report said no work at unprotected heights, and even with that restriction, he was able to work as an electrician with no problems. But then a new supervisor came on board and had concerns. And in many ADA cases, we see that problems arise when a new supervisor comes in who doesn't want to continue accommodations or has a different view of disability or often is not adequately trained on the ADA. And then because of this new supervisor, several medical evaluations were requested. And again, we have the same thing with the doctor. A physical therapist initially cleared the employee, and then they walked through the site with the supervisor who talked to the PT, the physical therapist, and then the employer's medical director issued restrictions that saying that Justice should not work in jobs that required him to maintain balance, work at heights, or at or near moving equipment. And based on those, they transferred him to a custodial position, which required that he work around moving equipment. And the court pointed to that to say the restriction against working at or near moving equipment was not in any other doctor's report. It was only in the report of Crown's medical doctor. And then the employer let him work near moving equipment anyway, just in a different position. And the employee filed at the EEOC. And the court held that Crown, the employer, regarded the employee as being unable to perform a broad range of jobs and therefore disabled and working. The court held that he was able to work as an electrician. He did that before, even with the restriction against working at unprotected heights, and that led to the inference that he was able to do the electrician job despite this restriction. And the court held that there is evidence that these hazards were imagined or exaggerated, and that Crown's purported reliance on Justice's medical restrictions was a pretext masking Crown's irrational fears about Justice's condition. Again, this is a case where the employer attempted to manipulate the medical information. Further, the court held that Justice did not pose a direct threat. While the harm was severe, if he did hurt himself or fall off a ladder, the likelihood of that harm was too small to constitute an imminent threat. And again, the direct threat defense is a strict standard. And one thing I want to point out, if an employer says to an employee, because the employee has epilepsy, oh, we're afraid you'll have a seizure and you'll hurt yourself, you can't work here. In those cases, I think employers are kind of painting themselves in a box, because if you say an employee can't work there because they're going to cause harm to themselves because of balance or seizure issues, then the employer is generally saying the employee cannot work anywhere, which leads to the conclusion that they're regarded as substantially limited in working. The employee still must show they're qualified for their position, but I think when employers make those broad type of decisions, they are regarding a person as being disabled. And again, training new supervisors, in this case, like many cases, people usually raise, and I think plaintiffs often should raise, I'm a person with an actual disability, the employer regarded me as being disabled, I have a record of a disability. Everything that applies factually should be raised under the various definitions of disability. And now we're going to move on to employees with a record of disability. One of my favorite albums there, Let It Bleed, which has the great message, this album should be played loud. And it should. Anyway, the record of prong of the ADA's disability covers employees who have histories of substantially limiting conditions that are not so limiting anymore, either because they're controlled by medication, assisted by reasonable accommodations, or no longer active. Or it may cover employees who have latent episodic conditions that have previously limited major life activities and may do so again if active. And again, under the ADA Amendments Act, some of these definitions would change, although the record of, I think, would not change as much as the regarded as prong. And again, employees to show that they have a record of a disability must show that they have a record of an impairment that substantially limits at least one major life activity, or that they were misclassified of having such an impairment. And a key point, they must show the employer knew of a substantially limiting condition. And some employers avoid liability because they didn't know that the employee had a record of a disability. And generally under the ADA, employers never have to accommodate disabilities they don't know about and cannot be accused of discrimination, or a discrimination charge will not hold against an employer who did not know that they had an employee with a disability. So we have the Sarmento case, which involves an employee with a back condition who had some minor lifting, bending and pushing restrictions. And again, the court said, well, these restrictions may have impaired his ability to work one particular job, but it didn't substantially limit him in working a broad range or class of jobs, and therefore was not, lifting restriction in of itself was not a disability. And because the record did not show a substantially limiting condition, therefore there was not a record of a disability. And the court also went that the employer did not regard the employee as having a disability. So that was kind of the trifecta for the employer. Okay, the next case is the Campmeyer case, which involved a woman who had endometriosis and several surgeries without complications, and also had some complications during pregnancies. And when she indicated she would need time off for another surgery, she was terminated, essentially because she did not submit the required doctor's note. But the court looked at her conditions and her surgeries and found that none of the conditions that she had in her past were substantially limiting, and therefore there was no ADA protection for her. As you can see, these cases regarded as cases tend to be a little more intense and a little hairier. Some of these other ones are a little more cut and dried. And next we'll look at the Knight case, where an employer refused to reinstate a police officer after the doctor cleared him to work and to return from disability leave. And the employee had evidence that supervisors told him the following statement. One, the city never reinstates officers after disability leave, and we have an unwritten, unofficial policy to that effect. He was told the city was afraid that he might, if he was returned to work, he might later go back on disability leave, and they didn't want to have to deal with the back and forth. And this led to the conclusion, or he was also told that officers on disability leave are viewed as being disabled. Once you're on disability leave, then you're just disabled forever. And in this case, Knight also presented evidence that he was sometimes unable to work at all because of his neck and back injuries, I think thus establishing his record of disability. And the court found that there was a record of disability and discriminated against Mr. Knight by not reinstating him. And again, here in the upper right-hand corner, we have, for those of you who may know, those are the Knights who say knee. Further in this case, as we mentioned, these cases often involve multiple prongs of the definition of disability. In addition, Mr. Knight was also regarded as having a disability. The employer felt he couldn't work, or perceived he couldn't work, regarded him as not being able to work, even though he could, and even though he had medical evidence showing that he could. And this was another jury award, which involved $150,000 in compensatory damages, reinstatement to the job, and back pay. And again, the employer statements hurt their case here. I don't know if you want to explicitly acknowledge that policy, but the real problem is the policy. And the fact that no one ever made the statements we alluded to earlier, there still would be evidence that no officer was ever reinstated after being put on disability leave. And I think that was the actual problem in this case. The next case is a very recent one. This case came down on July 1st of 2008, Doe versus the Salvation Army. The person wanted to use an alias to protect their privacy. This case involved mental illness. It involved a person who showed up for a job interview at the Salvation Army and admitted that he had used, when they asked him about medication, he told the truth and said that he had used psychotropic medications. And at that point, Salvation Army stopped the interview, said that the insurance would not cover Mr. Doe. End of story. Doe offered to get a letter from his doctor saying he could work fine. They didn't want to hear of it. And the court found that in this case the employee had a record of a disability and that the employer acted improperly when it refused to hire him based on his medical record. The court also acknowledged that the fact that the employer asked medical information before extending a conditional job offer meant they may have violated the medical inquiry provisions of the ADA. Employers cannot ask any medical information until extending that conditional job offer. And this case was under the Rehabilitation Act, which is the same analysis as the ADA cases. The Rehabilitation Act covers employers who receive federal funding. The next case is the Ainsworth case, which involved a substitute teacher who, at first, when he was hired, did not tell the employer that he had a seizure disorder. As he did not require any reasonable accommodation, he was certainly within his rights not to disclose his disability. There was no evidence that the employer actually asked for medical information, so it wasn't as if the employee deceived the employer in any way. Several months later, he told the substitute teacher coordinator that he had a seizure disorder, did not give any specifics, did not describe how it affected him, and still received substitute teaching jobs after making this disclosure. Go to the next slide. And then one day while on assignment, the substitute teacher issued some what was we call erratic, unusual, and inappropriate behavior. An eighth grade math class, this is math class, he wrote sex on the overhead projector, asked students to discuss their experience. He instructed students to discuss their sex lives with one another. The teacher actually, and I'm quoting from the case, licked the chalkboard in a lewd and lascivious manner, and at one point forcibly removed a piece of chalk from a student's hand and pushed the student into the hallway. The court held, one, there was no evidence that the employer knew of his record of an ADA qualifying disability. The employer knew he had some seizure disorder, had no basis whatsoever to know whether it was substantially limiting or anything like that. And two, as we talked about, anyone, whether or not they have a disability or regarded as or a record of, can be terminated for violating rules, for improper behavior, for performance problems. And here the inappropriate classroom behavior constituted grounds for terminating any teacher's employment and was a valid non-discriminatory reason for the termination. In this case, the employer did a good job documenting their concerns. They focused on his conduct in the classroom and administering discipline. And again, employees need to be careful about disclosure, and it's certainly not a good idea to request to disclose a disability until an accommodation is needed. But employees do have a duty when they do disclose to make sure not only to let the employer know about the nature of the disability, but any limitations flowing from it. That's very important. Or as in this case, the employer didn't have enough knowledge to be accused of discrimination. They did not know enough about his condition to know that he had a record of a disability. And now we're going to move on to the last part of the presentation, which involves discrimination on the basis of an association with someone with a disability. Reaching back into a song, Windy, if anyone knows it, they can hum a few bars at the end. One I want to point out, EEOC guidance I mentioned is very helpful, and while there's no explicit guidance on regarded as or record of cases, that guidance is generally contained in other EEOC guidance on undue hardship and reasonable accommodation, medical inquiries, and other ADA issues. The EEOC does have question and answers about the association provision of the ADA, which I think was last updated in 2005. And generally to find EEOC guidance, I open Google, I put EEOC guidance, disability, you can put association, and you should be able to get the EEOC guidance very quickly. The association clause protects relatives and caregivers from adverse employment actions based on misconceptions, fears, or assumptions related to the individual's relationship relationship to a person with disabilities. Sorry about that. And again, employers may take actions against employees for non-discriminatory reasons, poor performance, attendance problems. Even if someone has a family member with a disability, they still need to satisfy the attendance requirements of the job. If there really is a direct threat, often we see most of the cases involve, for example, someone who has a partner or family member who may be HIV positive, and the employer thinks, oh, now this my employee is going to become HIV positive, and courts have not upheld that type of action by employers. They found that to be discrimination. But if there is a bona fide direct threat, that may be a basis for taking action against an employee. And any time there's a reduction in force for valid business reasons, that is generally upheld. I see there's a question from Rick, or should have known. I think it's going back to the last case. So the employer knew he had some seizure disorder, but didn't know the limitations. Should they have known the limitations? Possibly. The court didn't get into that issue so much. I think here, because the employer is so much focused on the conduct of the employee, I think even if the court held that the person in the Ainsworth case did have a record of disability, their conduct, their inappropriate conduct in the classroom still would have led to the conclusion that they're not qualified to do the job. But I appreciate that. It is interesting, you know, based on what they have known, should they have known of the disability? Right, I think that's what I was saying. They knew he had the seizure disorder, but they didn't necessarily know it was substantially limiting. And I think in reality, even if they had known, the person's performance still was unsatisfactory and justified termination. Association claims in general. And just so you know, the joke in the Marx Brothers picture on the right, Groucho is taking Hartwell's pulse and looks at his watch and says, either this man is dead or my watch has stopped. Sorry, I'm trying to add something to the legal talk. Courts have identified three situations in which the association clause may apply. One is a situation where there's adverse action based on expenses that employer may incur because of an employee's relationship with a person with a disability, generally health care costs, medical expenses. The second situation is where an employer regards an employee as disabled because of the relationship with someone with a disability, for example, a relationship with someone who's HIV positive. Or the third is what's kind of called a distraction. The employer fears that the associate's or the employee's disability may distract the employee, the associate's disability may distract the employee from satisfactorily completing job duties because of their need to care for the person with a disability who they are associated with. And these are some of the factors in association cases. One, whether the associate, and by the associate I'm referring to the person with a disability who's associated with the employee who does not have a disability, whether the associate has an ADA qualifying disability, again, like all ADA cases, requires a case-by-case determination and an individualized assessment. And one thing, too, just on a tangential point, in some of the cases, the courts look at, well, maybe the associate didn't necessarily have an ADA disability, but what if the employer regards the associate as having a disability even though they don't? So can there be an association claim based on the fact that the employer regards the associate as having a disability? And I don't think the courts have answered that. It seems to make sense that if the employer is taking the action and it's their misjudgment, that if they regard an employee's spouse or child or partner as having a disability when they do not, then the employer still may be liable under the ADA because it's the employer's subjective view that's involved in that situation. Another factor is whether the employer knew about the employee's association with the disability. Next is whether the employer took adverse action against the employee because of this knowledge. The adverse action or the knowledge about the association with a person with a disability does not need to be the only factor in an employer's decision, but if it is a determining factor in an employer's decision to take adverse action, then it may violate the ADA. Next case we have is, I believe it's pronounced Ennis, which involved the employee who was a guardian for a child who was HIV positive, and the employee was warned several times about poor performance. They were late for work. They made frequent errors. The employer terminated her because of this poor performance. And the employee claimed, though, that's not why they terminated me. It was really my son's expensive medical bills, and pointed to a memo written 6 months earlier, an internal memo where the employer warned that a few expensive cases could dramatically increase the company's insurance rates. In this case, the employer also documented the employee's errors and performance problems very thoroughly, too. The court ruled that the employee did not establish that her son's HIV qualified him for ADA protection. It was asymptomatic, and it was unclear whether he had an actual substantial limitation in a major life activity. And the court kind of raised the question, well, did the employer regard the employee's son as having a disability then? But they never really got to answer that question. The employee also did not establish actual knowledge on behalf of the employer that the employer knew of her son's condition. She did not establish any connection between the employer's memo about insurance rates and her termination. They thought the 7 months in between was a little too much time to indicate what's called temporal, or to indicate a relationship. The temporal proximity between the memo and the termination was too distant. 7 months, the court felt in this case, was too long a time, although I think other courts may have looked at it differently. The 7 months doesn't really seem to be that far removed from the termination. And the employee did not submit any evidence that the employer specifically feared her son's medical bills. So in some of the other cases we'll see, the employer said, you know, we're worried about your husband's medical bills. Do you think, you know, rather than all this treatment, maybe you should just go to a hospice? And we've seen employers say things like that, which I think would have led to a different ruling in this case. And the court held that the poor performance, which was well documented, was a valid non-discriminatory basis for terminating the employment, and the poor performance was not disputed by the employee. And again, it's important for employers always to document poor performance and to follow policies regarding progressive discipline. In this case, the court said HIV is not a per se disability. It's not automatically a disability. Under the ADA, every case requires an individualized assessment whether a person's condition is a disability. But it's interesting because the first U.S. Supreme Court case on the ADA, Bragdon versus Abbott, cited there, involves someone else with asymptomatic HIV who is viewed as being protected by the ADA because they were substantially limited in the major life activity of reproduction. That reasoning probably didn't apply here because the employee's son was too young to engage in reproduction, but in that case, even though the HIV itself was asymptomatic, the limitations it imposed on the individual in the Bragdon case were seen as being substantially limiting. And again, the question I posed, was the son regarded as having a disability? Maybe yes, maybe no. The evidence wasn't clear in this case. The next case is Trujillo versus Pacific Corp, which involved two employees for the same company, and their son developed a brain tumor and accumulated at least $62,000 in medical bills under the employer's health plan, and the employer was self-insured, which I think was evidence that they certainly had concerns about medical bills of their employees and their employees' family. Within weeks of the child having a relapse of his brain tumor, both parents in the company were terminated. Purportedly, they were charged with falsifying timesheets, but the evidence showed that the employer was very inconsistent in the timesheet procedures. Some supervisors would do things one way, others would insist on different documentation, and that the parents' alleged violations were not that severe, and other people did timesheets the same manner and were not disciplined. So there, the employer's inconsistency in their timesheet procedures, I think, hurt them. Additionally, there were memos where Pacific Corp designated medical claims over $50,000 as high-dollar ones. They urged their supervisors to be aware of such claims. They kept a keen eye on cost. Each employee's health care costs were actually factored into the budget as labor costs. And I think all these conditions make it different than the case we looked at before. Here, the temporal proximity between the relapse and the timesheet investigation was only 11 days. If you remember in the case before, the court said 7 months was too long a time to really show a time relationship. Here, 11 days really suggested a causal relationship between the relapse and the timesheet investigation. These employees were treated differently, as there were many different methods for substantiating timesheets, and these employees were treated more harshly than other employees who had similar infractions. And to determine whether employers have non-discriminatory reasons, courts will look at weaknesses, implausibilities, inconsistencies, or contradictions, in a sense to see if the employer's purported reason for the termination, let's say bad timesheets, was really just a pretext because they wanted to terminate the people to keep their health care costs down. And again, the court distinguished Ennis the earlier cases due to the temporal proximity, 11 days, not 7 months, and the heightened concern that Pacific Corp showed with medical costs. That was not evident in the Ennis case. And again, the employer's concerns about medical costs and suspicious discipline created an inference of discrimination. Consistency in procedures in terms of timesheets and discipline and among managers is very important. One of the ADA best practices is centralized decision making because it becomes very difficult where some managers grant accommodations, whereas in similar circumstances, other managers do not grant accommodations. All employment decisions should be documented to establish that they're taken for legitimate business reasons. And again, the burden is still on the employee to demonstrate pretext. And I wanted to briefly mention two cases from the Seventh Circuit. One is Larimer versus IBM, a 2004 case, where the employee said, well, IBM is concerned that I have two children with disabilities, and that's why they fired me. But they had no evidence, none of the evidence that was here in the Trujillo case, and the court found it hard to believe that a company like IBM would really care about individual health care costs that much. And whether that's true or not, the real problem in the Larimer case was the employee did not submit any evidence to show that the employer cared a great deal about medical costs. And the other case I wanted to mention is in the brief, but not in the PowerPoint. It's a Seventh Circuit case, DeWitt versus Proctor, Proctor Hospital, which was decided in February of 2008. And the site will be in the brief, but if people want it, it's 517 F3rd 944. And that case, this is the same court that decided Larimer. In the DeWitt case, the employer was self-insured, and there was that evidence showing that they cared about costs. And I think that becomes the key in some of these cases. The employee really needs to show that the employer did care about costs and can't just make a blanket allegation that they did. The next case is the Erdman case, a couple more to go, and then we'll take questions. I know we're running a little over, which I apologize for, but anyone who wants to email me after the fact, if we don't get to all your questions, I will be happy to do so. In Erdman, a new supervisor revoked an employee's part-time schedule, which was given to her in order to care for her child with a heart condition and Down syndrome. And again, when employers do something not legally required and then decide to revoke it, employers are perfectly within their rights to do so. The employee agreed to go full-time, but then was told her scheduled vacation was no longer approved. And she said, okay, you're going to withdraw my vacation now. She wasn't happy, but then said, well, I want that time as FMLA leave. And the employer then decided to listen in on her calls that day and heard her using improper language. At one point, the employee was on the phone and said in a loud voice, this is a personal call and should not be reviewed for quality purposes, and then kind of swore at the coworkers who, I guess, review calls for quality purposes, and was terminated the following day. And the court held that the employer may have violated the ADA. One, revoking vacation time and denying FMLA leave show the employer's concern with the employee's need for child care. And they also held that there was no ADA violation by revoking the part-time schedule. There are no reasonable accommodations, as we mentioned, in record of cases. The analysis is, again, it's important not to put ADA-covered employees under a microscope. Oh, you want leave, you need to care for your sick child, I'm going to listen real closely to your calls today because today's the day you requested FMLA leave. The court kind of saw through that as not really just objective monitoring as phone calls is something the employer did because the employee raised some disability issues. There was no FMLA violation as the employee was not FMLA eligible. But again, even when employers are not covered by the FMLA, leave may be available under the ADA. I'm going to do some practical tips real quickly, and then we'll go to questions. I just see some typing. I'm hoping everyone can hear me okay. Most of these we've talked about, so I'll go fairly quickly. Practical tips for employers. Again, base actions on observable conduct, not just conditions, diagnoses, assumed traits of conditions, or suspected conditions. Employers should always perform individualized assessments, should document all events relevant to decisions, particularly performance-related ones. Employers should be careful of relying only on a company doctor, especially if the doctor gives an opinion that's very different than the treating physician or tries to influence other doctors' opinions. Employers should make sure they follow the ADA in seeking medical information. But again, employers never have to keep any employee who is not qualified and able to perform their job. I think new training for training for all new supervisors, as well as regular training for staff, is very important for many employers. I think it would eliminate a large percentage of the ADA cases that we see. And remember that adverse employment actions is broadly defined. Obviously, a termination is an adverse employment action. A demotion is, a pay cut is. But even a lateral transfer to a position of equal pay but lesser status may also be an adverse employment action. Employers should not base anything on fears, stereotypes, or assumptions. And in assessing direct threat, employers should make sure they have medical evidence. And again, if you say, well, we don't think it's safe for you to work because you have epilepsy, then employers need to realize they're pretty much saying the employee is regarded as being substantially limited in working. And the question becomes, does their epilepsy or other medical condition really make them unqualified? It's always important to look at accommodations and to use the best available objective medical evidence. Again, these are tips for employees. And just like employers need to document everything, I think employees need to document everything, particularly statements of supervisors indicating date, time, who is present. That can be very important evidence. Again, employees do not need to disclose a disability unless or until a reasonable accommodation is needed. Again, employees may need to request a reasonable accommodation if there are performance problems. Employers can take adverse action. So if you're an employee with performance problems and you think an accommodation will help you improve performance, it's important to request it. And again, reasonable accommodations are generally not required in regarded as cases. Actually, there's a mistake. They are often required in record of cases, but not required in regarded as cases or association cases. So I'm sorry for that little misprint. It's really regarded as cases and association cases where reasonable accommodations are generally not required, although there is case law that accommodations may be required in some regarded as cases, and often accommodations are required in record of cases. But under the ADA Amendments Act, accommodations will clearly not be required in regarded as cases anymore. And again, employees, when they disclose information for an accommodation request, they need to disclose the medical condition, the limitations caused by the condition, a suggested accommodation if known, and how the accommodation would be effective. If an employee is filing a claim of discrimination, all the prongs of the definition of disability that apply in that employee's case, obviously you don't want to allege something that's not factually accurate, but everything that may be, maybe you have a disability, maybe the limitations are not that substantial, so you may also want to throw in the possibility of being regarded as having a disability, or possibly if there's a record of a disability, of alleging that as well. And that's it. We've reached the end. We will now throw it open to questions. People may either type them in or use a microphone and a headset. So I apologize for running a little over, and I know I went through a lot of information, so I hope we have time for questions. And again, people are free to email me as follow-up.
That states, can employer ask for entire medical records from doctors or psychologists upon request for reasonable accommodation or only enough to show need? And is it a good idea for employee to provide these records at the time of a reasonable accommodation request?
Thanks, Robin. I just thought, hi, Cindy, thank you for your question. That's a good question from Cindy in Tennessee. The EEOC has guidance. There's not a whole lot of case law in the medical information, but I think the EEOC guidance is very helpful and very clear. And the medical inquiry guidance, which is, I think I alluded to earlier in the PowerPoint, it says employers can only ask for medical information if either the disability is not apparent or the need for the accommodation is not apparent. So if someone uses a wheelchair and they want to have their desk raised or their door widened so they can maneuver in their office, I don't think medical information would be necessary there. It's apparent why the person needs the accommodation. Additionally, accommodation requests need to be limited and tailored only to show the existence of an ADA disability and the need for a reasonable accommodation and possibly how the accommodation would be effective. So when we see cases where employers ask for 5 years of medical records in response to an accommodation request, we fight those because I think that violates the EEOC guidance, and that's an overbroad request. The medical information sought should be very narrow. And I think for employers, that's a good idea too, because I don't think employers want more information than they need. One, if an employer doesn't know of a disability or the existence of a disability, they cannot be accused of discrimination. Two, once employers have medical records, there's a whole host of laws that come into effect. The ADA has a confidentiality act. There's HIPAA. Many states have medical confidentiality acts. I know Illinois has one related to mental health and developmental disabilities. So once an employer gets that medical information, one, under the ADA, they have to keep it separate. They have to keep it locked. Only people who need to know should have access to it. And there's all this potential liability if the information is not used properly. And then to get to the second part of Cindy's question, which I think is great, is it a good idea for an employee to provide records at the time of a reasonable accommodation request? Great question. I think it is. I advise clients, if an employer doesn't know a person has a disability, I'm sure there's people somewhere who, after 2 years on the job, disclose to their employer that they have bipolar disorder and are HIV positive, and the employer says, great, I'll promote you instantly, we'll give you a better job and more money, and I'm sure that might happen somewhere. But generally, when employers get that news, there's a little bit of a surprise of learning of the accommodation. Sometimes there's a feeling that the employee was holding back on them, even though there was no duty to disclose. So I think if the employer will be entitled to medical information, I advise employees to submit that with the accommodation request. I've actually spoken with doctors and helped crafted letters. I don't think it needs to be long, just a short letter describing the disability, the limitations, the need for the accommodation, and then submit that with the accommodation request. I think it makes it easier for not only the employee, but the employer as well. The employer no longer has to guess, do I request information? Will I get in trouble for asking for information? How much can I get? You've really given the employer everything they need and everything they're legally entitled to make the decision. If the employer still wants more information, generally the best practice is to go back to the employee and they can get the information from their doctor. I generally don't think it's a good idea for employers to be speaking to employees' doctors. And I say that as someone who often represents employees with disability, but even the EEOC guidance says the next step, if there's information that's vague or unclear, is to request that the employee seek updated information from their doctor. So that's a great question, Cindy. I hope that answer helps. Are there any other questions at this time?
I don't have a question, but just compliments on one wonderful presentation, Alan. I learned so much. Nice job.
Well, thank you so much, Steve. I appreciate that. That's nice. Thank you very much. It's hard to tell sitting here in front of a computer screen. It's very different than speaking to a live audience, so thank you for that feedback. I see there's a question from Jane Teeter. Is disclosure of a disability on a job application for affirmative action purposes considered medical information and kept separately? Yes, it should be. It should usually, if it's for affirmative action purposes, it should be made clear that the information or the disclosures requested on a voluntary basis, but that should be considered medical. Anything that's medical information is medical information should be kept separately. Usually I think they're kept in HR departments and it should not be shared with immediate supervisors or coworkers. And if anyone else has any information on that question, please feel free to contribute as well.
I think the thing that Mrs. Robin comes up here is that that's on all employees, not just employees with disabilities, but any medical information on all your employees should be kept confidential, even if it's an employee that you don't know at this time has a disability, but if it's medical information, it should be kept separate.
Thanks, Robin. Yeah, I'm sorry for not making that clear. That's absolutely true.
At this time, if there are any additional questions, either just type them into the box. I know this is sometimes an awkward format for people because you don't have that face-to-face contact or even voice contact, but would encourage you to ask your questions now. A lot of information came forward today, and here we have a question. I'll turn it over to you, Alan.
Thanks. This question comes from Kristen. Can you discuss the requirements improving regarded as substantially limited in working and the need for vocational rehab expert testimony? Oh, boy, not an easy question. A good question, but a really hard one. As I alluded to, and there's more information on this in the brief, in terms of showing that someone is substantially limited in working or regarded as substantially limited in working, you generally either have to show that they're regarded as being substantially limited in working in a broad range of jobs or a class of jobs. And then the question becomes, well, how big is a class of jobs? For example, is nursing a class of jobs, or is healthcare professional a class of jobs? How big is the class you're looking at? In the case we discussed, I think the Squibb case, she may have been regarded as limited in working as a nurse, but maybe not as a healthcare professional. And unfortunately, there's very little clear guidance from the cases. They do often look at Department of Labor, Dictionary of Occupational Duties, or there's a Department of Labor dictionary which describes certain job duties and classes of jobs, and several of the cases refer to that. I think vocational rehabilitation expert testimony is often a good idea in these cases, because to show the limitation, there's also a geographic component. You have to show, you know, whether other jobs are similar in terms of licensing, skill, and other qualities. And that's the hard thing about ADA cases. Generally, you often need medical testimony to establish a disability. And then you need to also have vocational rehabilitation or other employment, other vocational testimony to show the qualification the person, even with a disability, is able to do the job. And perhaps vocational expert testimony, no, there's only, you know, nursing, there's a lot of nursing jobs. But if it's a specialized job or a specialized class, you may want to show, well, there's only, you know, 10,000 jobs in a 500-mile radius. And some of that testimony can be very important in showing whether someone is substantially limited in working a broad range or a class of jobs. So the courts really don't give a lot of clear guidance, and I feel that I'm probably not giving a lot of clear guidance either. And I think that's why the courts sometimes get confused and find someone's not regarded as being disabled when in fact they are regarded as being disabled but just not qualified for that job. But I think your comment about expert testimony is a good one. It can often be helpful. But those are the general requirements. I think when you look at the brief, that's explained a little more and probably a little more succinctly than I just did. But please let me know if you have a follow-up. And I'm going to go to the next question, which is from Lee Henson. Do the rules change in litigation? Do employers have broader access to medical information then? That's a great question, too. And we've had cases here that I've worked on where one of our allegations is that the employer improperly sought medical information, and then as part of the discovery process, the employer is entitled to get a lot of medical information. I think that is generally true, and it seems a little bit, I don't know, unfair or Kafka-esque in a certain way that you're protesting that the employer asked for medical information, and now you have to give them the information you're protesting about and more. And that is true, and it is a reality. Part of what we do to resolve that is we generally enter into protective orders, limiting who sees that information, maybe the company, maybe a few decision makers, but the company should not have general access to that information, as well as penalties for wrongful disclosure. So generally a protective order as part of a lawsuit is involved in order to protect the medical information. Hope that helps your question, Lee, and certainly feel free to follow up with an email. I can even send you some draft protective orders we've used in several different cases. And I'm just going to keep going on to the next question from Cherie Sanders. If part of the workplace rules require that employees report to work at a specific time, but if a person's disability prevents them from adhering to that work schedule at all times, Would that count as a valid reason for an employer to terminate the employee if he's regarded as having a disability? Well, again, that gets into a couple of questions. In the last session, I believe, on qualified issues, we discussed there was a case involving an employee who used a wheelchair because of inadequate accessible parking, was often late coming back, and the court held that the employer had a duty to accommodate him and maybe let him start a little late as long as he made up the time. In the regarded as situation, it's a little different because employers generally do not have to accommodate employees who are regarded as having a disability. So if the court follows that thinking and the employee does not have an actual disability but is just regarded as having a disability, and the court rules that there's no accommodations required for regarded as employees, I think that would pretty much end the case. But if the person is, if accommodations are available to that person, either because they have an actual disability or because the court follows the ruling in the Williams case that regarded as employees may be entitled to accommodations, then the employer needs to look at whether it's reasonable to modify their punctuality and attendance policy and allow the employee maybe to start a little later. But the employee still would need to make up the time because employers are never required to lessen the requirements of a position. And then Lee has one more comment about having disclosed medical information. The administrative promise is a false one when necessary to go to court. Yeah, once you go to court, a lot of the privacy you're trying to protect on the ground, kind of a lot of that goes out the window. So it becomes much more difficult, and it is a strange situation. And I'm not sure what the answer is other than what I alluded to before with the protective orders. So we have a few minutes left. I'll turn it back over to Robin, and we can go to the slide for our next presentation.
Great. Thank you very much, Alan. And again, a lot of information, as you could see by the number of slides that Alan had and the depth of the conversation that we've had today about this particular topic, and one that, as you said, hasn't really been given a lot of attention, but it does come, and it is an issue for employers and individuals with disabilities alike. I do thank you for your participation today and do remind you of our next session, which is in September on the 23rd, again a Tuesday from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Central Time. The topic that month is direct threat and safety in the workplace. We invite you to join us for that particular program, and that will be the final session in this series of programs. We will then look to our next year, which we'll be getting the calendar out in the future, near future. I also would like to just let you know that we also have an ADA audio conference program that is a monthly program via the telephone, streaming audio on the internet, as well as real-time captioning on the internet. That program, we have a special session coming up on August 12th related to the ADA Restoration Act, and we will be hearing from representatives from the disability community and business community. We have a representative from SHRM who will be joining us to discuss the various issues around the compromise language between the ADA Restoration Act introduced in 2007 in both the House and the Senate, and the ADA Amendments Act of 2008, which was passed by the House in early July and is currently in discussions and debates within the Senate as to what they will do with their version of this particular piece of legislation. So we would invite you, if you're interested in joining that session, again, that's a special session of our monthly audio conference series. It'll be held on August 12th from 1 to 2:30 p.m., again, via teleconference. If you'd like more information or to register about that program, you'll be able to do that by going to the www.ada-audio.org website. And from there, you can link to the ADA Audio Conference Series, and you'll be able to access the registration for that August 12th program. There's more information, description of the program available on that website as well. So we invite you to join us. We also ask you to fill out our evaluation form. You'll see the evaluation on a link here in the chat room, but also you'll be getting a follow-up email from us with a copy, as I said, of the PowerPoint slides, as well as the legal brief prepared by Alan and Barry Taylor from Equip for Equality on behalf of the DPTAC Great Lakes ADA Center. Along with that, we'll again send you a reminder for the evaluation form. So again, thank you very much for participation in the program, and everyone can sign off and have a great day and a good rest of the week. Thank you.